Good evening, everyone, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight's guest is Dindayal Morgan. Dindayal is the director and founder of Pathfinder Institute, School of Yoga Heart Meditative Movement, and is a certified Kriya Yoga Swami. His recent book, Lone Wolf in the Company of Fools and Mystics, recounts his spiritual journey as an African-American born into the welfare system. It relays his victories over racism, a dysfunctional family, and sexual abuse, which are all transformed through spirituality with heart. Let's learn more about this remarkable journey by welcoming him to the show. Hi, Dindayal. How are you?
Greetings. Yes, thank
you. And did I pronounce your name right? Is it Dindayal?
Yes, Dindayal. Yes.
Dindayal, okay. You know, I really loved your book.
Thank you.
It touched my heart, and I loved all the pictures of your family and the various other things that you put in there, and you know, meetings with your spiritual masters. It was really a warm. I just felt like I connected, you know.
Thank you.
And there were many events in your life that were similar to mine, although, you know, you have a different skin color. You know, some of these things are just translate into, you know, we're humans. We're in the human experience, Spirituality 101.
Truly, truly.
So let's find out more about your journey, and when did it begin? Tell us when you started to...
Well, I would say that when I was... I would say like around 14, you know, I always wondered in the early years why people did what they did.
Mm.
And maybe it was naivety or whatever it was, but for example, I was brought up in the church, and there was there was an aspect of the church that always, you know, I thought, well, maybe this is the way to this thing called God. But what I was observing in this young age was I was observing people behind the scenes doing things that were it just didn't go together with what they were saying at the pulpit. And it made me realize that everyone, you know, I wasn't very articulate in being able to speak because I had a speech problem in the early years of my life, up until around 12, 13. And I couldn't talk, so I couldn't say anything to anyone. So I used to observe those kind of things, and I was wondering, people don't always say what they do, and they don't always do what they say. And that was the first assumption. So it put me on this interesting quest to find some type of sense out of the madness that I saw.
Uh-huh.
It didn't make sense. You know, give and take, I was a young guy at that time, but I felt that If a person, you know, in the early years, children, you know, they go by what you say. The minute you start lying to them or you say things and you don't follow through with them, they begin to develop their own way because you're the first impression that they see in the early years. And my mother, she, you know, bless her soul, she did the best she could, but at the age of 16, she had me. And my father, he didn't really know how to be present. And so it sort of gave me this whole thing of, I need to find some kind of answers, you know. And I had the opportunity; I could have went totally the other way, you know, and really got involved with the law of crime, you know. But I did not, you know. I didn't totally go into that arena.
Good.
So, you know, and then as time progressed, I started to look at actually other aspects of the teachings and different teachings and the questioning, you know, the whole the thing behind fire and brimstone and the fear tactics that was used to get you to believe, and that didn't make sense either. There was something about it, and I couldn't really say much because I would probably get slapped down if I questioned anything too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, I began to see, as I started to progress and go into those fields, I just wanting to find some answers. And I think that one of the turning points, I feel, that it was actually when I just said out loud, and I've said this, and I said this when I was standing in a church, and I said, please reveal yourself to me. If there's a thing called God, show itself. Reveal me in a way that I can understand it, because now, you know, I don't understand anything, and I don't really know what's going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I've seen the things that happen behind the scenes, and I just, and I've also been a victim of those things behind the scenes, so it's like, you know, and so it put me on the quest to really find the self, and so, I mean, if I could say, as time progressed, it got me involved with the studies of mysticism. And it was almost as if, you know, when your mind is sort of fixed in a certain point where what you're looking for and what you really want to find, there's a way in which the universe has a way of opening up to you, and it directs you towards you. It's, you know, it's called the law of attraction, as you know.
Most definitely. What were some of those early experiences? You briefly touched upon it, and I know that in some of the Catholic Church, there's quite a bit of abuse of, you know, the young boys in the Catholic Church. I don't know which church you grew up in, but is that the kind of thing that was going on where the preachers would be preaching about, you know, sin and so on and so forth, and then behind the scenes they'd be, you know, having incestuous sexual things with kids?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And that was pretty common.
It's pretty common. Matter of fact, what most people don't know, and I think some of the listeners out there would also verify, is that there's a lot of things that were happening, not just only in the Christian you know, arena, but there were things that happened behind the scenes, and some of, like, even one in the early Hare Krishna group movement, they had their thing going on, and then there's other things that are going on in other groups, you know, even this in forms of Islam. There are many things that are happening in any organized organizations or organized religious groups that are always something that sometimes is not spoken.
Mm-hmm.
And then you even find these certain things that are sometimes in ashrams. And people say, "Wow, ashrams!" You know, if it's not properly structured and it's kind of loose, you can, anything can come up, anything can happen.
Oh yeah, I've heard that, and it often does.
Definitely,
especially Rajneesh was one of those. I guess there were some pretty wild times there.
Oh yeah.
Even the esoteric school that I was involved with, I didn't find out till years later. We were studying Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and that I didn't find out until after I'd left that the teacher was seducing the young men and their sons.
Oh my
gosh. And blackmailing them into having, you know, forcing them to have sex, or else they'd have to leave the school. And the impression was that if you, in a school, you have a possibility of evolving and being spiritual, and if you leave a school, you're dead.
Hmm.
You know, so that at that point, I think a school becomes a cult.
Yes, it does.
And you know, I think most of them are cults anyway.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing that, Lance, that most people don't, I mean, we're talking about a subject that is very secret and hush-hush, and because we're bringing this out like this, there's a lot of people out there that are listening that really can relate to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that it's time now to really get it to the forefront and forgive, let go, and move on.
Yes.
And, you know, I know it's easier said than done, but there's a way in which, you know, there are certain things that have happened to one's personal life that it's actually a signpost. It's a way in which, okay, I've been through this, now how can I use this to help others?
Right.
How can I share this with other people that this will not happen to any young people? Because one of the most traumatic traumas in those stages when you're young like that, it takes, you know, you don't really understand. So here you're going through life and you're going through all types of unnecessary traumas and dramas, and you know, you have therapy. Definitely.
Yeah. So what do you recommend? I mean, how can people who have had those traumatic experiences begin to heal them as part of their spiritual path?
I've felt, and this is one of the things that I have observed over the 40 years of teaching, is that one of the things that is more prevalent is this thing called movement. 75 to 80% of all communication is based upon body language, and the rest is based upon tonization, how people use words. Now, understand the nature of the body language: wind, water, ground, fire, space. I'm using principles based upon the shamanic. Now, in Ayurvedic, we talk about Vitta, Pitta, and Kappa, you know, but they still use the same elements. But from their standpoint, this is more of a shaman point of view, which is more, people can more grasp the concept. And so when you look at wind, water, ground, fire, and space, space is just the thing that holds all these things together. You start to look at, what element am I? How can, once you know, I can, you know, what you do, we go through a certain specific movements, which takes about 5 or 6 minutes. And as you go through that movement, you begin to relate to the type of element you are. And as you go through that element, one of the things that you do, you know how you begin to realize how you hold on to elements. I'll give you an example of what I'm saying. One of the things is this. If the listeners out here, if they relive an experience, a very traumatic experience, notice where they feel it at. When they feel it, because a lot of us hold what we call traumas or past pains in certain parts of our body.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, when they get really traumatized, they relive an experience. Some people's stomachs, they get very nauseated.
Oh, that's mine.
Yeah.
It's been like that all day long, too.
And then some people, when they have that, their throat starts to close up.
Yeah, yeah.
And then some people have this, the back starts, they start having problems with their back. They start feeling very painful in their back. And these are actually areas, it's called cellular memory, where we hold on to those particular traumas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you find a place where you hold it at, you place your hands over that particular part of your body. And as you place your hands over that particular part of your body, you give yourself a declaration. And you say to yourself, I give myself permission to let go. Now people say, oh yeah, if that was that easy, boy, that would have been gone a long time ago. But what most people don't understand on this world of what we call gross matter, when you make a manifestation or want to change something, it takes a little bit more time.
Uh-huh.
Now, in reality, the realistic time, it will take approximately about 30 days. Within 30 days, that you keep repetitively saying this constantly, spend about, I would say, at least 15 to 20 minutes twice a day.
Okay.
In the morning time before you retire, and keep giving yourself that direct declaration. You say it out loud vocally.
Okay.
Because when you say it vocally, what happens is your subconscious picks it up. And there's a problem. When you first start off, your mind say, this is stupid. No,
right.
You're not. No, you still feel the pain. This is ridiculous. But what most people don't understand is that normally when you keep doing that, and you keep doing it over and over again, you set up a pattern called self-talk. And as you keep setting up that pattern, your body will start to register it. And it will actually start to let go. It will actually let go. And you'll find in between those 30 days, as you touch that area of your body and give that declaration, I give myself permission to let go, something in those within that 30 days will lift. As if something was lifted off of your body, a heaviness will leave from that area. And I'm telling you, it works. It's one of the most powerful techniques.
Well, I'm going to try that because I just was involved with a situation. I won't go into the details, but where I had an opportunity to be a victim, and where there was I was lied to or manipulated, and it's a very unpleasant feeling. So, you know, I carry all that in my stomach, you know, because my empathic skills always warn me through my stomach. So I'm going to try that for 30 days and see how that works, because it's so simple.
Definitely, definitely.
And I have heard that these things work, but you need to consistently do it for at least
consistency.
22
That's one
or 30 days.
Yes.
Another question. What advice do you have for those who might be in dysfunctional homes? Because let's face it, there are a lot more dysfunctional homes now than there are normal homes, or living in poverty. And how did you work through your situation and not become a victim? How did you work through your victim consciousness?
One of the things that I did, I woke up one day, and not so much as woke up out of a sleep getting up, but as I was walking through life, something dawned on me. And what dawned on me is that none of this stuff was making sense that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
I was, you know, I grew up in the welfare system. My grandparents were in the welfare system.
Mm-hmm.
Mother was in the welfare system. I was in the welfare system. So it's like, why am I doing this? I asked the question. Why am I subjecting myself to this? And I really genuinely feel that had a lot to do with my search to make sense. Now, there are other people around me that have grew up in that same situation, but their mind was not focused on anything. Matter of fact, they thought it was okay, you know, to swim on the system or to manipulate or cheat the system.
Right,
you know,
right.
They thought it was okay.
Yeah.
You know, and if I would make a gesture, or say, hey, don't you want to stop this? Well, maybe sell some drugs. No, that's not the way either.
Right.
Well, what do you think, man? Well, find a way in which you do something that you really enjoy doing. Something
right,
that
right.
gives you great joy. And just do that. Oh, well, there ain't no really immediate money in it, man. I don't want to do that. And I say, no, just do it. You know, just see if it works for you. See how it goes. You know, so what it did, it put me on this quest to really make a change. And so what I did, I wound up working 3 jobs. My third job was the thing that I really loved, but I had to work in order to pay the bills and keep the family together. I had to do a whole bunch of things in order to get to that point. But as time moved on, I kept making this affirmation and this declaration to myself that I don't know, please reveal to me what I need to know.
Mm-hmm.
And then as time moved on, that's when I met my spiritual teacher in 1971.
Mm.
And that started to change because I was putting out this call for help. And I guarantee you, those of you that are listening out there in Radio Land, one of the things that you really need to understand that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there has to be a conviction from the heart, a cry from the heart that, please, send a teacher to help. I need to move on. I need to find this aspect. Teach me. Share with me. And those things will start to manifest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things also there's another key implementation that you can use when you're stuck in what we call a negative relationship, as well as being in what we call a whole house environment that is really not beneficial to you,
mm-hmm.
and you feel like you're the sort of like the black sheep of the family, or you feel like, am I really, why was I born into this family? They're crazy as hell. You know, and one of the things that you have to do, if you're young, you have to look at, okay, you know what, I need to step away from this, and I need to surround myself with people that support, or people that have the likeness of mine. And if I continue to hold that thought in my mind, you will actually attract it. You'll find yourself one day involved with a group of people that are like mine.
Uh-huh.
The mind, what people have forgotten, the mind is a magnet. Whatever you constantly think on, whatever you hold on to your mind, you will attract.
Mm-hmm.
You will attract. And so it's very important what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It's the old saying, if you go in somebody's room and you look on the stuff they have on the walls, and if it happened to be a whole bunch of pictures of naked women, you can pretty much know where the person is at in their mind.
Right, right.
You know, and so what we hold in our household and what we have on our walls is a reflection of our subconscious self,
mm-hmm.
and is a reflection of how we do in life. And so it's imperative that you surround yourself with things and people that support a higher level of consciousness.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Now, in 1971, when you met this teacher, what path did he follow, and what did he recommend for you? What kind of teaching did you follow initially?
Well, initially it was Kriya Yoga, but prior to that, I had several teachers. One was very unusual. He was, let's put it this way, he practiced the dark art.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
Danger Will Robinson.
Yeah. I really didn't put too much in the book about that because that would have taken
I've met people
place.
Who practice that, and it's really scary stuff.
I know. And he was very much in that particular order. Things that I saw him do.
Oh.
And I he took me in and sort of worked with me on that, but that was a very short aspect of time. I mean, it lasted for several years.
Uh-huh.
And I learned a lot about what people can do and what they really can't do.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that was one of the early years of training from that thing. And I left that because it just wasn't I thought that this wasn't right.
Yeah, yeah.
So I moved on. And there were other several teachers and things and people that owned Donut, but the major teacher was the teacher that I met in through the Temple of Kriya Yoga of Chicago. His name was Goswami Kriyananda, and his teacher was Shelley Trimmer. Shelley's teacher was Paramahansa Yogananda.
Mm.
So I come from that particular lineage.
So wonderful.
And that's where, you know, that's where I really began to study. Even then, when I first started off, there was a way in which the teachings really confronted my fears, and it confronted things that I didn't want to look at as I was walking and going through it. Prior to that, I had started martial arts back in 1966, and I became very efficient, you know, in that field and kickboxing and the whole concept, you know. And you know, but when 70, it changed a whole bunch of things in the way of how to look at the fighting aspect. And I still kept the martial science back. I still kept that together. People often would say, "Well, you know, you're doing this yoga and you're doing this martial arts. Isn't this in contradiction? Ahimsa?" You know, nonviolence, and most people don't understand we're all soldiers in a battle. It's not so much as what you're doing, it's your intention behind why you're doing it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I began to realize the balance, and I kept the martial, but I started looking at the balance of the martial science and how it fits in, and how, you know, the intention and energy and movement plays a major role in how what's going on internally from a microscopic level inside of our bodies, because we're constantly fighting what we call antibodies and other things that are going on, foreign things that are not really conducive. It's called the immune system. You know, there are cells that are dying and rebirthing again. And if they don't defend you, you're in trouble, you know. And so on that small scale inside of our bodies, what do we make, you know, does it really make that much difference in what's happening on the outside? Because there's a lot of things going on the outside. Every time you step out the door, every time you turn on anything or look at anything, there's always someone or something that's subliminally programming or sending something to you or selling you something or tell you how to look. Because we're living in a world of images.
Yes, you're right about that.
Oh, by the way, those of you listening to this, you know, you can always go to my website, PathFinerInstitute.com. That's PathFinerInstitute.com. You can also call me, if you wish, at 925-695-3121. That's 925-695-3121.
Good. And you work with clients today, yes?
Yes.
And how do you work with them? Are you teaching some of the mixtures of the various spiritual pursuits, or is it more of the martial arts side, or a little bit of all of it?
It's a little bit of all of them. Well, give you an example. Some of my major clients that I'm working with now is people with addiction. You know?
Okay. Oh, good, because I had a problem. You know, I worked through my addictions years ago, so I know this is a very big area.
Definitely.
How do you do your work with addiction?
When you're working with addicts, one of the things that most people don't quite understand is that because of their drug addiction, whether it was meth or whether it was cocaine or heroin or marijuana, whatever it may be, one of the things that happens when the long-term addict is using, there's a way in which they leave their bodies. They constantly are altering their consciousness and either shifting down into the lower astral or somehow shifting into a place where they start to see things a little differently. Because of the long-time usage, they develop what we call, in some ways, a thin skin. Their level of sensitivity, they begin to feel. Now, based upon the type of usage of the drug that they're using, there's a way in which either something starts to deteriorate, something starts to really affect the body in a way where either they become paranoid or either they become physically ill. Things start not working as well.
Right.
But my point is this, is that what happens is they become very astute. They may not be able to be articulate in explaining what they're feeling, but they do it. Just like when I'm working with youth. And I'm working with the youth, it's very, very beneficial because they can feel where I'm coming from. I don't have to use a whole bunch of words. And so when I'm working with people in addiction, I use movement as a key, you know, based upon Mayo Mota Musashi's work, Book of the Five Rings, and it has to do with the elements. And I have them go through the elements and feel aspects of themselves. I incorporate the principle of the posture, and as I hold the posture, I move them in from what we call a therapeutic point of view, and ask them, okay, notice what you're feeling while you're holding it. Notice your breath. Is your breath steady? Notice how much you inhale and how much do you exhale. See if you can keep it even from that point. Notice what you're feeling in the body, part of the body that you're stretching. Now, touch that area, relax into it, breathe into it. And just have them just to be in the present moment.
Uh-huh.
And then from that point, I take them to a series of movements that involve what we call fear, moving past the fear, and ask them, okay, I want you to relive an experience of using. Now, for some of them, they're terrifying. Uh-huh. I say, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, you let me know. But I'm here, and I can give you something to counteract it. And I have them go through a experience when they want to use.
Mm-hmm.
And the minute, because the body is programmed, it's pre-programmed for the years of usage, some people start feeling in parts of their back. Some people, their hands start to sweat, literally sweat, because they're getting ready to use. Okay, I say, now, stop for a while as you're holding it. Intensify it to a point where you feel like you can actually go use. Now, while you're feeling it, notice everything that's going on. And what I do, I give them a series of what we call acupressure points that I tell them to do to themselves. Like, for give you an example, push your tongue against your teeth. And as you push your tongue against your teeth, place your left hand underneath your right rib cage and hold it there. Now, it varies from one person to another. And because I'm an intuitive, what it is, I feel exactly what they need to do in order to counteract that particular movement. Now, in some cases, they can tell them to put their both hands in tight, right up underneath the sternum and push in there, because a lot of times, a lot of the trauma they take place, and when people get into that place of trauma, they start to feel it in their tummy. And so what happens, if they can push against those nerve endings that are in the aspect of the tummy, they can neutralize a lot of the triggers, and combine with a certain position of the tongue, they can actually alter it, and it can soften the usage. And so those are some of the techniques, but see, like I say, they vary from one person to another, but they are always, always 99.9% correct.
What is the most common drug that seems to be abused today that you see with your clients?
Well, I would say meth.
Meth
is it's a crazy drug, because it also stems and it gets into violence. I mean, all drugs can leave it that way, you know. But meth is it screws around, and I mean, all drugs can mess with the gray matter in the brain.
Right.
But meth has this, has another, it does something else. It really is. Those are one of the things. And then cocaine, you know, those kind of things like that.
Yeah. Now, what about overcoming other aspects? Like, there are some very common things that we're going through now, like depression, anger, and fear. What kinds of techniques do you use for overcoming those?
One of the things that you can do is called the... this is the term they use for it is called the warrior approach. And you face the fears by standing in an upright position. And as you stand in an upright position, slightly bend the knees. And as you slightly bend the knees, go into the mind. It's called time travel.
Oh.
Time travel is called memory, because we all go back in time and we go to different points of experiences. And relive the experience of that fear. Just relive it. And as you relive it, notice where you start to feel it. In what parts of the body? What parts of the body do you feel it? And you just sort of stay there. And just notice what... Now, for some people, some of my experience of with most people is they really... They are so, what we call, conditioned to cover it or to block it. It's very hard for them to get to that place.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard, unless they actually physically end the experience itself. But what most people don't really understand is that basically the experience is really going on in your head. And the physical aspect is just, it's almost like a mirror being reflected back to your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us know that if you think or felt long enough of an experience, you will actually start to feel it, like it happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And so while they're standing, have them go through that. Now, one of the most advisable things to do is in front of a mirror, because most people don't like themselves. In our culture, everybody's trying to be somebody else.
Yes.
You know, and so the first thing is self-recognition and self-love of the self. Not to a point of this pure ego, but from a point of view that you are part of creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're part of the mechanism that makes things move and work. You know, and you have a right to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do is you look at yourself in the mirror, you say to yourself, and you ask yourself as you feel this fear, and notice how it comes into your body, notice where it focuses at a certain point of your body. And this is where the whole thing comes back, that I give myself permission to let go of this fear.
Uh-huh.
And as you do that, as that area that you're doing it, you hold it, and then you bring your arms out from it. Now, these principles of movement, simple, they may be very simple, but they are very powerful. And these are the principles of movement psychology. What I have observed in the past 15 or 16 years is that movement psychology has a powerful impact on purging and getting people out of what we call the deep level of their subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very powerful practice. It's one of those things, and usually these types of movements you can also find in Feldenkrais and Alexander techniques. Use the term ATM, awareness through movement. There is something about the human body that we are missing here. I see so many people that are in the spiritual practices or ashrams and everything, and everybody's trying to leave the body. And
right.
The question is, how can you leave that something that you need to master?
Right,
the old
right.
ones, what they have forgotten is that they said in the early practices that learn to master your physical form
right,
before
right.
you move into the aspect of spirituality. And people, they keep doing the opposite. They're running away so much from themselves, and they think that by going into those places that, you know, okay, it's great, until all of a sudden they find out that, this stuff is here and there. Oh, my God, I got to move on. And they keep running away from themselves. So
right.
the major objective is to really master yourself. So doing that technique and doing that in the mirror and just giving permission and opening the arms up and saying it with declaration, with consistency, it changes.
In your book, you mentioned the four key principles of real happiness. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes. Do you have it in front of you?
I don't have the four principles in front of me. I might be able to find them.
Because one of the key principles I'm trying to see it, because I always attempt to stay new with what I do.
Mm.
You know what I mean by when I say new? It's called the beginner's mind. If we look at the first principle, be true to thyself. I know that's one of the key principles of being true to oneself. And let's see. And that starts with really recognizing where we're at in our lives and the things that really just don't work for us, but we try to make it work because we don't want to offend daddy or mommy or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've got the OMAC principle, which consists of four stages: objective, motivation, action, completion of action. Was that it?
No, that's the OMAC principle. That deals with creating things in one's life using that principle.
Now we see a chapter on Journey to India.
Yeah.
That might be interesting to find out about. I have a friend that's in India right now. When did you go to India, and what was that like?
That was during the tsunami that happened in 2005.
Oh, geez.
I was up in northern India during that time. That happened in southern India.
So what is India like? And are there, is it, I've heard it's a place of many changes. I mean, it'll just blow you away. It's so strange.
Yeah, it's India, like any other country that you go to, culture is different. It was a major culture shock. But there was something very simplistic about the country. Really simplistic. Not really. I mean, there are certain areas that you would go to. There are the rich and the real poor. And we're not talking about the kind of poor we see in America. We're talking about this dirt poor. You know, and
literally dirt.
Yeah. But it was I learned a lot about people. And one of the things I learned was what we call the principle of the baker's dozen effect. And the baker's dozen effect is this. It is said by the old ones, and it's said by those who know the order of things, that if you want to have a successful company, always give 10% to charity. Give 10% some way, or 5% in a way to helping others that are less fortunate.
Oh, I agree with that.
And, I mean, what was very interesting about the baker's dozen effect was basically that when I went into the marketplace, and even though I couldn't really speak Hindi and any other dialect that much, each time that I would buy food or something like that, they will always give me something a little extra. You know, and I remember going into the marketplace and they'd say, hey, have some tea. Come. I mean, if they didn't like you, they wouldn't care to deal with you. Just like, move on. You know, but their way was like, hey, have some tea. And sit down and have tea and we would talk. And there was a way in which the human factor was always a part of their business. You know, the baker's dozen is that I always give more. I give them more. You know, I give them 13. Here in America, you get 11.
Right.
You know.
Right. Or less.
Or less, yeah. And so what people don't understand, that type of mentality, what it is the customer. There's a saying that a corporate guy told me. He's like, you know what? I believe in the old way of treating customers the way they're supposed to. What we have now is a problem in what we call public relations, where people they have very little patience with you, and they give this. And sometimes when you're in their presence and they're working with you and trying to sell you stuff, the interest is not in you, and so we can't have that. He was saying that in order for us as a company to really be productive, we really have to learn. Personal relationship. We must understand the nature of people. We must serve the people first before the money.
Absolutely. It seems that it's about making that personal connection, and that's what, you know, ultimately brings in or makes success.
Definitely.
But if you're focusing on the end result and the money, then the people don't matter to you.
And people can pay. People are not stupid. They can
know.
They can read where you're coming from. And it's like, yeah, okay, guy. Yeah, all right. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like you just can't do that. You know, we are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most virtuous things that we can do as human beings is to love and respect each other,
mm-hmm.
even though we may not agree with each other. You know, we can still respect each other.
Absolutely. I love this picture of you standing in front of the Taj Mahal. Did you go inside there?
Oh, that's a beautiful place.
Is it?
Beautiful place.
What's it like? I mean, what was your impression when you walked in through the front?
I felt, as I was approaching, it was almost something out of a storybook.
Really?
It's like this place has a tremendous amount of energy and history, and the walls have a certain vibration to it. The way that they had it cut off inside, there are certain places you can only walk to. Then they had wire, sort of wide mesh around just to protect you from going any further and down, like down into the cavern, the basement or whatever.
Right.
But the inside of the walls, these walls were reconditioned, some of them, and then there's other pieces that are just there ever since that place was created. And as you walked the marble, there was this awe of this person committing himself to dedicating this, you know, the love that he had, and just sort of spending years and years and years of developing this. And it was an interesting place because I saw so many people. This is almost like it was like a Mecca where people would come in, and I saw a student and a disciple there that he was teaching his young disciple, I heard him happen to hear him talking briefly about the whole aspect of this place and the energy of it is, and you know, and it was just a place of awe, because it's one of the, some people call it one of the seven wonders, because it has this mystical, this majestic aspect to it. You know, there's something about it that the ground, you know, it's kind of hard to explain these things in a way, because it's almost like trying to say it in Chinese or say it in Hindi, and people are not really understanding it, and so it's like, wow, that sounds so beautiful. But when you're there, there's an experience of it that it's just something that you won't forget.
Magical and mystical and spiritual.
Definitely.
Yeah,
all
that
those.
There's much more to it than you feel the vibes of maybe thousands of years of energy that's gone into that.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. So, let's see now. What else do I want to ask you about?
We didn't get the four principles, but...
Yeah, we didn't get those. I couldn't find that one. There's a few questions in your book that you've discussed a little bit. What's your impression of today's human beings based on your years of experience?
Wow.
Now, I know what you said in the book, but now you're going to have to figure out what you're going to say on the air.
Well, here's the thing. you want to phrase that question again?
Okay. Let's see if I can maybe phrase it a little bit differently. What's your impression of today's human beings and where they're going?
Okay.
I'll put it that way.
All right. And I'm only coming from my short time. I haven't lived completely 100 years or so, but being a teacher, it puts me in a whole different frame. I'm constantly, 24/7, mirrored. I'm constantly being mirrored back to, and I'm constantly seeing this aspect of human nature in the raw, and it keeps me in check.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps me sharp. It keeps me honest. And one of the things that I've observed, and what I, you know, in this present day, in this present society, is this thing of how can I say it? It has a lot to do with a lack of honesty.
Oh yeah.
You know, and the honesty is not so much as somebody lying to someone else, but it actually has to do with them lying to themselves.
Yes, absolutely. I see that too everywhere.
And it's almost as if they put on this pretensions, these pretend of grandeur of what they are and who they are, and in truth, they're just lying to themselves.
Yeah. And yep, I see a lot of that too. And you know, another thing that I think we're kind of skirting around it is that most people have turned towards or are focusing on material things and on acquiring more material things. And as a result, they're not really happy and they're not really satisfied. And so the spiritual aspect of the self is getting buried deeper and deeper inside of one's body. The soul, the spirit, is not being expressed, and so a lot of people are feeling frustrated and angry, and they probably don't know why.
I know, and pretty soon as you start to acquire, I mean, it's nothing wrong with material wealth. It really isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but the problem that usually arises from that is that when you make it your God, or you make it something better than spirituality and better than divine connection, because everything physically is transitory. Nothing stays the same. If it has a beginning, it has a preservation, and it also has an ending.
Mm-hmm.
And what people don't understand, if you keep trying to focus to try to get satisfaction in a material thing, whether it's a woman or a man or whatever, you will always wind up short, because people that we love dearly will one day leave us.
Mm-hmm.
It'll either be by way of death, or we outgrow each other.
You had one of your relatives appear to you after he died, didn't you?
Yeah.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
I believe that was my grandfather.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. He, Grandfather Pruder Morgan, he came, and he was looking at me with this beautiful smile of approval.
Good.
And as he did that, he kind of, there's a way in which that was saying, okay, when that happened, that was very interesting, because when that happened, my wife happened to also notice there was a presence in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And as he did that, he turned. And as he turned, he walked, you know, went through the wall. I took that as a way of connection,
mm-hmm.
and a way of which he was concerned. He was concerned so much that the energy that took him to actually create that etheric body, that form,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just to say to me, and I knew it was him because I felt it, you know, with just a feeling. He had a wide brim hat and one of those types of suits from the 40s.
Yeah,
you know.
But yeah, he was smiling.
Yeah, he was smiling. It was a very interesting experience.
So it sounds like he was telling you, I mean, just on the surface of it, that he was approving of your direction.
Yeah.
And he was saying hello, and then also telling you that he was fine.
Definitely.
Yeah, isn't that
all
wonderful?
All in the same thing.
That's wonderful. Now, you've been working with yoga for quite a long time now. What do you consider to be the true yoga?
That which is of the heart.
Oh, wonderful, yes, of course.
You know, and that can be many different systems that may have that, but if there's no heart in it, and it's just all superficial, a bunch of circus contortions,
uh-huh.
it's one thing to do a posture, trikasana, or a triangle pose, and do it with such perfect skill. It's another thing to take the yoga and use it in your personal life to deal with all types of adversities. Most people, it's easy to teach a person how to stand on their head, really is.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most difficult things is teaching them how to stand on their own two feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of the commercialized aspect of yoga in our country, each time you pick up a magazine, it's always some thin, anorexic-looking female, blonde, blue eyes, always showing the image of this is what yoga is. And so most men think yoga is for women, when in truth it was actually designed to work with men in the early centuries.
Wow, I did not know that.
Because they were the ones that, you know, needed the really... Most people in many, many centuries ago always felt that women always had a connection. And if you look very carefully, I believe one of the ancient Chinese proverbs talks about whenever civilization falls apart and whenever the structure of the family is lost, the female principle is not present.
Yes.
When we come back to the female principle and mother in the household, the family will become strong.
Yes.
And the nation will thrive. But we don't have that. The female has been lost. There's a total imbalance.
Oh, absolutely.
In our society.
Absolutely. Don't you feel that the divine feminine is going to make a more dramatic appearance and infuse into our society if we're ever to balance ourselves?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely. There's a shift coming.
Yeah. You tell us about that. What's your perception of the shift?
Well, I feel personally and also astrologically a lot of shift coming into play. I mean, I'm not a master in astrology, but I do study the basic principles of them. And, you know, like, for example, we have Pluto that's moving into Capricorn, and that has a lot to do with change. It has a lot to do with government.
Uh-huh.
And there's other things that are going on also. I mean, but if we look at the things that are happening right now in our society, there are certain symbols, because life is always speaking to us from a symbolic point of view
all the time.
And some of the symbols that we've seen, we've seen an imbalance of the power in our country. And dominated by men that are not too well.
No, they're not.
You know, and so there's a way, there's almost in a way that the female voice has been silent.
Yeah.
And have not been able to speak out or bring a sense of balance to this. Or say, look, stop for a while. Look, you're really going in a place where going to create more anxiety, more pain, more hate, more hurt, and more death. And so I feel that as we move in this aspect of society, there's a way in which we have to honor the female principle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you feel that these times, I feel that they're more accelerated, and, you know, there are a lot of people who follow the Mayan calendar in their time frame, which says that in 2012 there's going to be an end to time when the galactic center lines up. Do you follow any of that stuff?
Yeah, but what do they really mean? See, that's the thing. And the time can be your time of your death, of your physical death.
Right, right.
The time can be the time of a certain type of thought bomb. See, we have what we call times of thought bombs, where they're prevalent for hundreds of years, and then at one point in time, that particular thought is no longer prevalent, and it cannot survive to the next millennium.
Uh-huh.
It cannot. And so what happens, there's a major shift and change in consciousness. Now, what I'm feeling from this 2012 is this basically there's an aspect of what we call a shift in consciousness that will take place among the people, the masses, to such a degree that it will alter the way we used to do things.
Yes, yes. And it seems that it would almost have to move out of duality and out of the idea that we are separate and into more harmonic thoughts and movement, and that we would be unable to create wars because we would see that, you know, the person that we're creating war against is ourselves.
Exactly.
That everything, if all of us are from one spirit, then, you know, how can you kill another spirit if that's you standing there?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So I think we're moving out of an old paradigm, which has become really focused on greed and corruption. And I think that's going to break down, and we're going to be seeing the birth of a new one.
But it's definitely happening. I mean, you can only go so far into darkness until you start coming into light.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And the darkness can't maintain itself.
No, it can't. You know, it's you know, this whole concept of the religious right and this here mixed with, you know, the politics and this stuff here and the mistreatment of people and, you know, you can't continue to do that.
No.
Because, you know, things will start to shift and change. And because of the level of consciousness of those of us that are self-consciously aware, we cannot allow that. We can't mix. And so what we have done in many parts of the planet, there are many of us that have created this aspect of positiveness, peace day, you know, the whole aspect of focusing your intention in your mind, and you affect vibration in the very ethers of the air.
Yeah.
You know, and as you're holding that, people don't believe that. They figure that they have to go out physically to go out and just do something to make it happen. It doesn't have to work that way. First, it has to start on the subtle plane of your existence.
Absolutely.
And move into the physical.
Absolutely. If every listener to the show just, you know, focuses on peaceful vibrations and releases their negativity, then even that creates a shift on
Definitely.
The planet.
Definitely. And you don't have time to send negative daggers and negative, what we call psychic daggers, to Bush. You know, he doesn't really need that. If anything, he needs to be compassion and love, even though, you know, we know where he's at.
Right.
You know, but, you know, there's a way in which you don't feed that kind of thing by
right.
sending out hate and negativity.
Right.
You feed it by nurturing.
It only perpetuates.
Definitely.
And it makes things, it perpetuates the fight. And it's not about the fight. It's about forgiveness and, you know, letting go and acceptance and allowance. And, you know, he's playing a role.
Definitely.
And it's a difficult role. It's not one that I would want to play. But, you know, he's playing it really well. He should get an Academy Award for it.
Yes, as a great actor.
Really.
Truly.
One of the best. He's come from a long line of actors that have filled that role.
You know, those are the kind of things that basically at this stage of our country that, not to get into too much of the politics of it, but there's a way in which we play a major role in shift. I was looking on the $10 bill today,
uh-huh.
and it said, "We the people." And for some reason, we've forgotten that.
Yes.
We have to come back to we the people.
Yes.
Because it is us that
yes.
make this government.
Yes.
You know, we are the people. A lot of our forefathers have died in order to create this aspect of this particular world
yep.
called the United States. You know, and
absolutely.
So we have to really honor and respect it, and at the same time, keep a vigilant and a focus point in the direction that is benefiting all people.
Absolutely. And focus your heart on love.
Definitely.
And not judging anyone else, because that's when we start going down that rabbit hole.
Definitely. And it's one of the things that most people can really get mixed up is like, well, you talk about love, is it just the passive love where they just slap you and kick you around? And, you know, we're not talking about that.
No.
You know?
No.
I mean, even the most cowardly animal, if you corn it, it will fight.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so we're talking about really understanding the nature of beings.
Yeah.
And realize that people do play a role in this world.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do something to try to go out of your way to try to hurt them, because they're doing it to themselves.
Yes. Absolutely.
And somebody else will play out their karma.
Yes, exactly.
So don't be the bringer of their karma.
Exactly, exactly. And don't create more karma for yourself.
Definitely, definitely.
By trying to play God and judge and take care of that other person's situation. Yes, absolutely right. I'm glad you said that. We're going to be running short of time in a minute. Do you have some lasting thoughts for us?
Well, remember that you can contact me on the web,
okay.
pathfinderinstitute.com.
Okay.
That's pathfinderinstitute.com. And my number is 925-695-3121, 695-3121. That's area code 925. I do special workshops, private sessions. And my old motto is this, that you got to have heart.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Dindale, where are you physically located in the country?
I'm located in Antioch, California.
Oh, okay. So you're here. You're not too terribly far from me.
Exactly.
Wonderful. So you people in California can check him out, and he's a wonderful guy. And I highly recommend your book, too, Lone Wolf and the Company of Fools and Mystics. And can they get that on your site or at Amazon?
Yes, they can. They can get it on they get it more quickly if they go to my site.
Okay.
And get it on pathfinderinstitute.com.
Okay,
pathfinderinstitute.com.
Well, Dindale, it's been a wonderful time talking to you, and I really thank you for joining us and sharing your insights and your love and your spirit.
Thank you.
And I wish you the very best.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Take care.
Good night, everybody.
Good night,
Dindale.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.